I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Welcome to the Syrupcast, Mobile Syrup's Canadian tech-focused podcast. I'm Dean, and today we have a special episode. We're combining the Syrupcast and the Syrup Arcadecast into one big thing. For those who don't know, the Syrup Arcadecast is Mobile Syrup's gaming focus podcast. During today's episode, my co-caster Brad Shanker and I have interviewed Black people in the gaming and tech industries. Before we get started, I wanted to thank Kadeem Dunn, Inobog Ite, and Funke Joseph for participating in today's podcast. Today we're starting off with Funke Joseph.
I know that we desperately want to make something that is just it's something that has all of us in it intimately, but it doesn't have to be about our identity, you know? Like, it's dealing with some of that at some points, but it's not like the core focus of it. I want to just make it possible for us to make art without our identity having to come into play all the time, which is like, it's important that we are this studio like of BIPOC LGBT plus people, but it's not like we're not making stuff specifically to just dissect identity. We're talking about so many different parts of humanity and culture and yes, gender and race as well, but it's all of these things together, and we want to be able to like show people, hey, look what we can make. And yes, this is the team that makes it. So hire other people and like give funding to people that can do this, because like it's not just the like classic video game guy like who has just been working in the industry for so long and is usually white. Like, there's other people that can make these games, and yeah, I just want us to show people, specifically people that don't care about video games at all, I want them to be like, oh whoa, like I could write a game, or I could do art for a game. And like, I know my friend who's a writer, like, let's collab on something small and make that and feel how that feels and like show that around and just have fun with it. And whether that's like as a hobby or as a potential career, like, I think that's a good thing that people around my age range should think about. Cause like, it's, you see all these things about layoffs and these posts and how the industry feels so doomed right now. But video games are good. Like, that's the one thing that hasn't changed, that they're actually still the same. They feel so fun. And like, the games that are coming out all the time that provide these sparks that you can't get from any other form of media. So I know video games are good. So I know that whatever these layoffs are, it's from like poor management and like bad faith, because there's no way that like it's just the quality of the games. Like, you see that it's all these stories that release about how people are managing things and like the expectations they push onto people at last minute. It's horrible. And I want to be able to create spaces where like my friends and I can be comfortable in creation and have a sustainable time while also uplifting our other homies and people like us that like don't get the opportunity or the even the thought of doing it. Cause like I'm someone who has been around games for so long. Like I've written about them for years, and I still didn't think until September recently that I could make a game. I was just like, it's not for me. It's for someone else. It's for those guys, like those people that like I've written about. But I just want to smash that barrier with what we're making. In short,
sure. And having the visibility of you and your team obviously it helps contribute to that. You know, speaking yeah. for your experience specifically, and I know some of the other people on your team are also, you know, of Black backgrounds, you know, we've seen more mainstream coverage of Black representation in gaming. You know, there's particularly been conversations lately around, you know, different types of Black hair or lack thereof in games. So sort of on a larger level, you know, what are some areas that you would kind of hope to see improve, whether it is the hair or other aspects of representation?
My only area of representation right now, and I've written so much on the subject, but right now I've realized that the representation that matters is happening behind the doors. Like, it's the stuff, the people that are on the team are the representation I want. I don't, characters, yes, that, like, of course, like, that means something, but from studying more and from writing these pieces, like, about Animal Crossing and Elden Ring, I've noticed that the stuff that actually matters is just having the creatives that, like, are Black and of all, are these different backgrounds to have the chance to create these stories, because they historically have not had the chance. And video games are such a young medium in comparison to, like, film and photography and TV. Like, it's starting now, so people should get into it, like, now. I think it would be really fun, and we would have so many stories that you're just like, whoa, especially if they're coming from a non-video game background and, like, they're a young adult getting into games. I want to play that game because I know it's not going to have any of, like, the biases or, like, common conceptions and practices of game dev that has been through the past few years. So it's going to be different in some way. And I like different, and I want more different stories.
No, that's a great point. And that was actually going to feed into one of my other questions. You know, we see the sort of, like, GDC surveys and stuff like that, where they kind of unpack the demographics of the people, you know, giving the responses. And sadly, the numbers are obviously not very good when we look at the number of, you know, BIPOC marginalized creators in there. So obviously we want to improve that. So, you know, what are some of the steps that you think game companies should take to bring in more diverse creators like you're talking about?
Yeah, I think good ways are to just make it more known. Something that I've seen on applications from some studios is saying, hey, even if you don't think you're qualified at the bottom of the application, even if you don't think you're qualified, please just apply. Like, there's so many people that are applying that just have that built-in confidence from, like, having whiteness as a power card, or, like, being a man as a power card, who just, like, feel comfortable applying even if they don't like fit that correct job description and those responsibilities. Like, they can't do that. Whereas people who aren't historically, they don't have that, those power cards, can't feel comfortable applying to that, because they're just like, oh, it's not even gonna, like, it might mess up my chances if I, like, apply and I don't have everything. Like, no, I think people should have more of a reminder of that, and, like, to have companies just be more open about that and recognize that that is a thing, because that's even comforting when I'm applying to something, or when I have, like, to see something like that, it's like, okay, cool, you're thinking about this at least. But other ways, I think, are just, like, from team conception, trying to either have the core team have diverse backgrounds, or have the core team be researched and constantly researching in diverse backgrounds, having a team of consultants from different backgrounds you can talk to and get real experiences from, if you're writing about a specific experience. And also, yeah, just, like, hiring those people from the start, like being like, who are the people that I want to tell the story, and who can tell it well, if it's about a specific community, like, get people from those communities. But also, if you have, like, if you're creating a character in a game, like, talk to someone from that culture, like, research that by, like, through talking, and also, like, reading history, or, like, watching a documentary. Like, it's really simple things that can, like, help you understand the other people on this planet better, and also make you make better art. Yeah, like, that's off the dome, like, what people can do for, like, BIPOC individuals and LGBT plus creators. And another way, I think, would be just being more transparent about what happens behind the scenes of games. Like, so much of the stuff I've learned from, like, a Zoom call, or, like, a random message from, like, someone else in the industry who I've worked at a publication with, or, like, met at some event, and that information just isn't available. So I've, like, took it upon myself to, like, share with friends who are, like, even interested in game dev. I'm like, no, I'll make the time. Like, I'll make the time. And if you make the time, like, it makes a world of difference. Like, I think of all the people that helped me with leadership and narrative help and just game development help from all of fall when we started working on our game. And I just don't think I would feel as comfortable and as confident without that. So for professionals to be that are in the industry, if they can't hire other people, make the time to like care about another person and help them get welcomed into this really cool space that's shrouded in shadows.
100%. And sort of on the other side of the spectrum there, you know, what advice would you maybe give to aspiring game makers, especially those who are, you know, BIPOC, LGBTQ+, et cetera?
I think you should make video games, first of all. Let's get that out of the way. You should do it. Like, no matter what, if you've thought about it, you can. You definitely can. There's a lot of software and tutorials online that can teach you how to do this. Like, that's how I learned. I didn't know how to program in this engine we were using before September, like when Max and I, our other programmer, just started watching YouTube videos together and practicing and like trying to make our world real. And if you care enough, like you can do that. And I want people to know that is possible, but also the fact that there's, especially if you're from Canada, like there's a lot of opportunities to get funding to prototype, to make something bigger that you want to like get commercial in so many different places in our country. So check that in, because not many other places have those opportunities. So I think, especially if you're in Canada, like look into those different grants and funding options and yeah, apply. Cause as I said earlier, like it's sometimes people are like, I don't know if I should apply. Like they want people to apply to these things. Like otherwise they're not going to be like giving out money, and like, they just want creative projects. A lot of these funders. So like, if you have that fire, like there's people that could help fund you for X amount of time to make that and to do whatever you want with that idea. So I just want people to know it's possible and look it up. And if you have any questions, they have stuff on the site, but also if you want like a person, like hit me up. If you want like from like someone who's done it recently, I can definitely help out anyone who needs an extra hand.
It is my pleasure to introduce Inobong Ete. I hope I didn't butcher that.
Yeah, you got it.
Awesome. Better known as Bored at Work, a creator who focuses on tech and gaming and gadgets with more than 540,000 subscribers on YouTube. Inobong, how is your day?
I'm good, man. I'm good. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for like joining us. We actually talked about you in our last podcast. I was talking about your yellow sweater, and because the whole podcast was about S24 stuff, and I was like, "Circle search yellow sweater." He got it from Zara. I will get it from Zara too now.
seriously, that feature is so clutch now.
It's so funny. Good. I'm such a huge, like, I love style, and I'm just like, yo, like, where did he get that? Where did you get that? Like all the time. It's great.
That's all my wife. That's all my wife. So I give her the credit.
Awesome. So let's get to the topic at hand, and that is Black people in tech. So Inobong, you've been in the business for a very long time, like forever now. I think over 15 years. Is that right? Yeah.
Yes.
Do you have an exact?
2009 was when I jumped in.
2009.
I know we're doing the math right now.
Yeah. Is that 15 years? Is that right?
Let's see.
Yeah.
Why can't I do the math off my head anymore?
I can't. Yep,
you're right.
I think
exactly.
Yeah. Exactly. Ah, sick. My research worked well. As a Black person in tech, did you find it difficult to get started in this business? And do you find there's any difficulties that you had to face compared to your white counterparts that started around the same time?
So I would say starting off was interesting for me in the sense that my background initially is microbiology. So I worked as a microbiologist and I started for fun. So initially it really was kind of just, you know, I used to have a website. So it was writing on the website first and then eventually making videos on YouTube, that kind of thing. I think the initial difficulty I faced was the kind of rampant racism that I got initially on YouTube. And I think, to be fair to YouTube, they've done a much better job in, you know, curtailing censorship, like all that kind of stuff to block things out. But I had people who would use the N-word all the time whenever I made videos, would make jokes. And, you know, even some people said, you know, I use my welfare check to buy a TV to review, even though I got it from LG, you know, things like that. So that happened. My response to them was always, thank you very much for watching and making me money. That's literally what I would type out, because, you know, they're still viewing. So which means you're making some revenue off it. But I would say I was blessed the fact that within the industry, in terms of reaching out to companies, I didn't face anything directly in that formal fashion. So whenever I reached out to companies, especially then when I had a lower subscriber count, they were very willing to send me stuff out. And it was just based on my level that I was at the time. So, you know, certain companies would be like, hey, look, we can send it to you, but you only can give it for 2 weeks because, to be fair, you've only got like 20,000 subscribers.
For sure.
We don't know. And I took that as, okay, look, I get it. You're still taking a chance and, you know, I appreciate that. So I think what I enjoyed was the fact that the companies I dealt with understood who I was and what I was trying to bring to the table. And that helped balance a lot of things out, because I had a situation in, what year did the iPhone 10 launch? I just can't remember the exact
2018?
Year.
Is that right?
Yeah.
That's wrong. I think that's wrong.
Roughly.
No, earlier.
Maybe earlier. But yeah. When the iPhone 10 launched, there was Apple had an event in the city, and Apple invited a bunch of creators. I attended the event. I covered the iPhone. And this was the first time Apple really opened up to creators other than traditional press. I dropped my video on the iPhone the next Monday, and my video blew up. I mean, it was awesome. Trending. You know, this was like one of the few times where like my videos went viral. I was like, yes.
Yeah.
And later on that day, there was an article from a website called Recode, which I don't think is available anymore. And that article talked about, basically, it was very subtle racism. I'll just put it that way. The reporter talked about the fact that Apple has gone away from traditional solid reviewers like the Walt Mossbergs, people like that. And they listed five older male white reviewers, traditional press. And then they've given it to I can't remember the exact word, but basically unqualified Black reviewers like Mike. They mentioned me, they mentioned Soldier Knows Best, and they mentioned your average consumer. And then they mentioned two others, one who was a lifestyle creator and another who was like a skateboard YouTuber. And I would never forget the responses I got from all the other companies and brands that I worked with on Twitter. They came to my, I never said anything publicly. I remember my reps from Verizon were like, you guys need to take this down. This is trash. I know these people personally. They do really good work. My Samsung rep said the same thing. Like every company that I had worked with really came out to my defense, which was great because I didn't
have
to do anything. But it was the first time I would say within, you could call them my peers, that I got that kind of response from. I get it that there was some... there was a shift between moving from traditional press to YouTube, you know, in terms of coverage. And I get the anger there.
Yeah.
I would be pissed too if I was just a regular
Still mad. No, I'm kidding.
But I wouldn't have steeped to such levels, right? So to me,
sure,
that was one of the things that I think that's one of the big things that I faced, but I was really happy to see that again. I had a lot of people who backed me in that regard. And I think it kind of boils down to, as a creator, doesn't matter what race you're in, but especially if you're Black in any field, it doesn't matter whose field. It's an advice that I take to heart that I got from my uncle when I first came to the States. He said, look, there are many people who will not like you in this world, but you have to be good at what you do and do it well. Because no matter how much they don't like you, if they need you, they will come to you.
That's a really good way of looking at it. But
because of that, do you think you have to work harder than other people? Like, do you think that, like, to garner, you have a huge following. Do you think that it would have been an easier to get if you were white? I mean, possibly. I kind of look at it this way. When it comes to tech, not so much.
Okay.
Not so much, because I think tech has the one beauty that a lot of the other aspects of content creating doesn't. People come for the tech. They stay for you. So they will always come to see the Galaxy video, the iPhone video, the, yeah, you know, the latest gaming PC, whatever they're looking for, right? Because, you know, your thumbnail may not just have you on there. It might just be, the device. And then they stay for you. And that's who you find. That's how you find your audience. Your audience is staying because they like you. And tech has that benefit as opposed to other aspects of YouTube where you are the subject matter. Whether it's lifestyle, whether it's fashion, you know, it's people are looking at the fashion on you, right? If it's lifestyle, they're looking at your lifestyle. And that's where you can see a lot more hate kind of increase in there. That's why I say tech is a bit different there, because we have the luxury of, yeah, I want to see the Galaxy. And even if you don't like me, but I say something that you really want to know, you're most likely going to listen. You may not want to look at me, but you're still most likely going to listen in that regard. So I think that's the benefit that at least tech has brought. Now, in response directly to your question of would it be harder, I think for me, it's not been a thought process. Just because I bring up my Nigerian background, being Nigerian, that's just what we are told to do. Doesn't matter who or where. So I don't think about who or what is happening. I just know that I have to ace it, or else, you know, then the excuses rise up. So I've always kind of looked at it from that perspective in that way. But I have to say, though, for me personally, like I mentioned earlier, I've been blessed to have favor with a lot of people and people liking my content, and companies I've worked with also supporting me in that regard of saying, hey, we trust you. We want you to do more stuff there. So I've kind of had more of that in my own line of work than most other people.
That's good. I always found that, like, for me, I've been in this business for half the amount of time as you, so 7 years. And I find that, like, still though, there aren't a lot of Black people in the room. So whenever we go to a conference or an event, sure, there's me, you, there's me, like, Tommy and MKBHD sometimes, but I still find that we are definitely the minority. But I'm sure that's changed a lot over the last 15 years. Are you finding it better now? Or are you finding that there are more Black people interested in tech?
I mean, see, that's the thing. It's there are more, but not as much as they should be, in my mind. And also, I think I don't want to make assumptions, because, you know, the barrier of entry in, you know, especially content creating, is much lower, in the sense that you just need your cell phone now. You know, when I first started, you still needed to buy a camera, all that stuff. Now it's your cell phone, and you can buy lights that are cheaper. You can get also a good, cheap microphone. Like, those things are easier to get into. But the difficulty now then becomes getting the tech to cover, right? Being able to get that access in there. And I think a lot of maybe younger Black creators are being stumped because the field is also larger. You know, there's just so many people covering this, not just in the US, just across the world now, right? You've got so many people covering tech. Now, the difference here, I feel, is that Black creators don't naturally have the liberty to do something weird, goofy, or crazy. That gets people's attention. That's just standard in life, right? You know, prime example is this. Take the Vision Pro. How many videos did you see, whether it's YouTube, TikTok, IG, people walking around with the Vision Pro looking like goofballs out there? how many Black creators do you see do that?
Zero? Yeah, exactly. I haven't seen that. A lot of different creators do that, but none of them are Black, for sure.
Here's the first thing. I wouldn't do it. I get roasted by all my friends. I'm Nigerian, but I'm also Black. Like, I'm not going to do it. That's just the natural, like, thought process, right? And also, it's also that process where if we did that, you know, I'm not sure, I don't know how, you know, the videos were edited, but were those creators called out for it publicly, or would a Black creator be called out for it publicly? Like, why are you wearing that? It's kind of stupid. You know, you might get, you know, I'm not sure if they did. Now, I'm not saying they didn't and they just didn't edit it out, right? But the mindset of us thinking that that is a possibility is like, no, I am not even going to try that. Let's put that up back of the way. So I think being able to do that, because if you look at the likes of like the Logan Pauls and stuff, they started their careers doing just dumb stuff. Some of them were funny, but I'm saying that as a Black creator, we don't have that liberty to.
But one can argue you have the kernel.
Yes, you do have the kernel.
Which is hilarious persona you put on, right?
True.
But it is kind of goofy as well. I mean, it's great, but it's...
But the kernel's inside, at home. Okay. I mean, once...
Still, you're not like out in public being the kernel. I get what you mean there. Okay, yeah, that's fair.
I'm talking about that like very outwardly approach to YouTube videos. You know, it's the, like I said, the Logan Pauls, the Mr. Beast. I'm not putting Mr. Beast in the same category. No one should confuse that. But just being able to kind of go out. There is a cultural limitation to it that we have. And there is also societal limitation to that as well. That makes it a bit difficult, you know. Yes, there are some younger Black creators who are kind of pushing in that boundary. But again, it's something that I think, you know, kind of comes to play, especially when you come to tech, where a lot of Black creators want to be seen as more serious. Like, I understand the tech. I know the tech. I can explain the tech to you. I'm not going to be the one who's going to be walking around with a Vision Pro and trying to order coffee or stuff like that, right? That's just the reality of what it is.
Do you think that we should be aiming towards that? Like, do you think that that's holding us back?
I don't think it is holding us back. I think it limits the amount of virality in terms of, say, social content. The reason I say that is, yes, granted, and some people will listen to this podcast and go like, but we have MKBHD, he's the biggest creator. And yes, he is. And he does fantastic work. But he's also really good at what he has to do. Here's the thing. I'm talking about the ability to showcase yourself and not have to be as fine-tuned. MKBG is really fine-tuned in his craft. He does a really good job. And he should be where he is because he does a really good job. That, to me, is just a meritocracy. It's like he put in the merit and therefore he should. You know, he put in the work, sorry, and therefore he should. But in the space we're in, there's so many levels for everybody to fit in, right? There's so many different places where you can have someone be just that goofy, fun, entertaining individual. He doesn't have to be a comedian. He doesn't have to be, you know, he doesn't have to fit a specific stereotype. He just has to be somebody that people want to watch because he does this or that. I just don't see that. You know, it kind of reminds me of a statement that one of my buddies made about Jaden Smith, Will Smith's son. And when he was making music, he was trying to act and doing stuff, and people were like, oh, he's kind of weird and funky. And he said something, and he was like, no, he's not. He's just being like every white kid. And then he's like, there's no offense to that. There's nothing wrong. It's just that because he is Black, or maybe Will Smith's son, at least at that time, this comes off as being at, like, you know, very weird and out of place, as opposed to he's just trying out new things and he's doing things away from the traditional norm that's here. You know, he's trying to go outside of that box. Not everything worked, of course. We know that. Not everything worked. But that's exactly what I'm talking about. It's like where it becomes a thing where creators are just, Black creators are just making what they want to make. And as long as it's good, to me, as long as it's good, it's not stupid, you're not hurting anyone, that's all that matters, right? Like, you fit those boxes and then that's cool.
So I want to go into more of like how racism is now for you. I know that if you're saying when you started off, it was really bad. But you just did a couple of Black tests for this S24 Ultra. And I do find that these like videos are really important to share. And when you do these tests, how is the response for people? I know whenever I write an article that focuses on Black anything, the comments are insane. Like I did an article on my love for the Spider-Man 2 game. And you know, I got just pure hatred. Like I just got like the comment section. Yeah. So how is that for you? Like, are and currently?
So this video, I've had this video idea for years, for a while.
For sure.
And it would have been it probably would have gotten worse comments because the camera tech was not as good as it is now. And I wanted to do a color spectrum was my initial idea. I wanted to do photos with, Super Saf, The Unlocker. It was like three of us taking pictures because we all are three different complexions, completely three different complexions.
For sure.
And seeing how the camera will handle that, right? Like, it's just like, hey, if three friends are hanging out, so how does it work? I just never did it. But with the S24 Ultra, I thought about it a little bit last year and I said, okay, I want to do more camera comparisons because I usually don't. I usually do a gaming video first. I do kind of speaker tests. But I was like, I can't do the same thing as Saf or Daddy Wingate because they do very in-depth, you know, camera comparisons. So I was like, you know what? I'm just going to do the Black test because I thought about the Galaxy S20 Ultra when it first came out. Every single reviewer initially said that camera was terrible. And it did have some fundamentally flawed issues, especially autofocus on that camera. But for me, it took the best photos of me. And I remember I did my video then and I said, this is probably one of the best cameras I've used. Everyone's like, oh my God, it's trash. This person said it's bad and this and that. And I was like, but you saw the photos. I was like, here's where the camera actually has issues. Then my wife was my girlfriend at the time. And my wife is Dominican. She's much lighter than I am. And I take a photo of her. It makes her look super, almost white. And then for me, because there's so much sharpness, it just hit my skin tone white. I was like, look, I look good. That's all that matters. I'm like, but I was like, guys, that's really the thing. And nobody really wanted to listen to me there. I didn't get hate. I just got people hating on the review than hating, you know, on me then. So with the Black test, I was like, okay, this is a very good time to kind of focus on that and see what it does. Because for a long time, most phone manufacturers just haven't focused on that. I'm not saying there's nothing malicious. It's just that cameras
are not made for Black people. That's just I learned that in J school. The white prof was like, yeah, cameras aren't made for Black people. They're made in Asia or in the States and Europe, and they're not made for us.
It's a tuning because if you are, you know, white or Asian, you're going to tune it first to yourself, at least around you, because that's what you know, right?
For sure.
You have to kind of do it that way. So I was like, all right, let's go ahead and take these photos. And it was interesting to see the comments were actually, for the most part, mostly positive. I had a lot of Black and brown folks were like, oh yeah, no wonder my iPhone looks like
this. Yeah, yeah.
You know, it's like, I thought something was wrong or I was making a mistake. And it's like, good God, you know, and that was what I was getting from people who were like, oh, okay, it's this. And then some other people, the people who were leaning to the negative side, like this must everything have to be about race. I was like, I didn't bring race involved. I just literally said the Black test because I am Black, so I'm testing it on myself. That's it. That's what it is. And a lot of people were like, go ahead and try the Pixel. You know, I knew the Pixel had, but I wanted, you know, test out the Galaxy and the iPhone. And the Pixel did a much better job with that skin tone representation, you know, and I'm like, this is what you know, eventually I want the guys at Samsung to see this and go like, hey, you know what? You did a really good job, but you still need to improve over here. And the iPhone guys should go, oh, we saw your video and we've done a better job. I'm like, that's all I want. Yeah. Well, I want it to be balanced that whenever anyone takes a photo, then that person goes, yes, this is my camera. Because at the end of the day, whatever photo you take, doesn't matter what race, what skin complexion, if you do not look good, that camera is trash. As far as I'm concerned, if you do not look good, it's trash.
And that's good that it wasn't as like bad. I did something similar a couple years ago. I did a color test with the Pixel 6 Pro because that was the first Google phone of real tone. And my comments were like, why are you doing this? Why does this matter? Who cares? Da-da-da. No one cares. And I was just like, bro, come on. So, I mean, it's been a couple years since then. And you are a lot bigger than I am, especially. So I'm sure that helps as well. So I'm glad to see that the reaction wasn't as critical, or not critical, but as harsh, I'd say. My last question for you is or I guess it's a two-parter like all of them have been, but is consumer tech a good industry for Black folks to really get into? And what would you say to encourage Black people trying to get into this industry?
I think it is. I think it's a very good industry. I think one of the things I appreciate about this is that you get a lot of lovers of tech. It's kind of like, it kind of reminds me of the lovers of Star Trek, right? It's a space where people are there for the wonder first, right? And people will have their biases. I think it's just human nature, whether it's just general bias or people who also veer all the way to one side. But I think it's a space where, because of the love of tech, it's easier for a lot of people to revolve around something. You know, it's like sports. Even, you know, you love a team. Somebody may not have dealt with someone who's Black before in their lives, or may have some prejudices. But once you love a team, you start talking, and they're like, "Oh, okay, it's cool. It's not what I thought. I must have been misinformed." And that's what I think a consumer tech is, at least for a generation. I think the other thing too is getting into it can be a bit difficult. And I would say cover tech in interesting ways, because YouTube is an ever-growing pool of creators that just keeps growing, right? You have to find your niche, or you have to find a niche to fit into. And sometimes you don't have to have the product. You know, right now with the way YouTube is, the way TikTok is, the way Instagram is, you can do reactions to stuff. You can state your opinions. You can cover leaks and rumors. You know, you don't have to necessarily have the product, but you can always have an opinion. And as long as your opinion is constructive and well-theorized, people will listen. People will listen. And then just think about the creation process. Look at your favorite creators. How do they make videos? How simple can you replicate that? Because we all copy each other. We all do. Like, we all copy things from different creators and how to do things and how that camera shot is. And don't think you need to spend a lot of money. Like I said, your phone is your first camera to use. You definitely want to get a microphone. Lighting, I would say, if you don't have the time or money for lighting, daylight, the sun is your friend. Wait for daylight and shoot. Just shoot in daytime, whether it's the weekend or something. But get yourself a good microphone, and they are really good, cheaper microphones now. You know, when I first started, like, I was using the microphone off my camera. Then I had to buy expensive microphones with like $600, $700. You know, those days are gone. I mean, you can still buy those, but now you can buy stuff that's affordable that works well. And I think that is key, because people will understand that you are showcasing yourself and what you know. And like I said, come for the tech, they stay for you.
That's awesome. Thank you very much.
Yeah, you're welcome, man.
Where can people find you, E?
You can find me on every social platform. It is Bored at Work, spelt with two O's. And I'm on YouTube, Instagram, TikTok, IG, X, threads everywhere. It is my pleasure to introduce Kadeem Dunn. I hope I'm saying that right. A game designer who focuses on the intersection of digital and physical lives and how our lives can be altered through the combination of play and technology. Kadeem also focuses on how socialization plays in both production and consumption of technology and media. Thank you for coming. I really appreciate it as well. Awesome. So let's get into the topic at hand. Black people and video games. What was that, Google or something?
Yeah. Hey, shout outs.
Do you miss Stadia?
I do a lot. Yep.
Think yeah. About it often. Are you one of like the five people who played it? No, no, I'm kidding.
Yeah, I know. You know what's jokes? Actually, at that event, Brad, the UTM one, I was talking to Victor Lucas after, and I was very surprised to see that he was using Stadia to stream some of his games. And he's like, yeah, I miss it. I think even with Game Pass and, a lot of thinking that even Switch is doing it, there are a lot of different way, and then NVIDIA, GeForce, like streaming through games is becoming more normalized. Can you stream PS5 games on PS4? I heard about that too. So yeah, there are a lot of ways now where it's becoming normalized, and so I miss it in a lot of ways. I think one of the things is, I don't know how much I should go into it, but like even with Game Pass, I noticed that there's the mode where you install the PC game and then you can also stream it, but then it's like a different your saves are not necessarily persisted, and you can't just switch. And I was like, wow, I remember we were able to do this years ago. So, and I think also the sharing of it, like streaming directly to YouTube was nice. Plus the ability to use the backend systems. So I remember Cyberpunk when it came out. Everyone was like, this is so buggy and all this stuff. And I was like, this is running awesome on Stadia. I'm having a great time. Just being able to swap between, the PC, and then even for Red Dead, like some segments I could just hop on my TV with the Chromecast. Anyways, as I don't want to go into this, but I do miss it. Yes.
Well, I hear you, because I was at the launch event for Stadia over at GDC in 2019, and I was like super blown away by the technology, and even the core technology, even if the games were always there, was always really sound, and even how they've used it in things like helping with Destiny 2 development during the pandemic when Bungie was sort of working remotely, or like the ability to like stream a Resident Evil demo into your browser is really cool as well. At Capcom, good to put them up on their website. So yeah, there are a lot of cool things that were being done with Stadia. So kudos to you, you guys for working on that.
Thank you. Thank you. I share it with the folks that are, a lot of folks have kind of gone into different areas of Google. So I'll let them know.
I didn't know there were so many Stadia apologists on this podcast, but let's get back to Black people.
One thing I will say real quick is I think the game team who never got to release a game, led by Jade Raymond, was awesome folks. I worked with them a bit, and one of the most talented like groups of people I've seen like assembled, so just the fact that they're never able to show anything is a shame.
Have you kept up with anything at all that they've been doing with Haven? Because I know a lot of that team kind of moved over to PlayStation. Obviously, wouldn't ask you to reveal any like secrets about the game, but just sort of on a broad level, with that team.
I've been keeping an eye. I haven't seen anything yet. But I'm very excited for whatever they make. Let me check now. I just realized, yes, I haven't checked in a little while. Have they announced anything?
Yeah, their new game, Fair Game, I'm blanking on the name, but it ends in a dollar sign. I think it's Fair Games with a dollar sign. Yeah, it's like a looter extraction shooter.
Oh, cool.
Yeah, which is cool because it's PlayStation's first Canadian studio, Haven, and it's led by Jade Raymond, so that's a lot of talent there.
A lot of the folks, yeah, are there. So I'm going to check that. I'm immediately a fan and very excited for that, so I'm definitely going to check that out.
All right, enough of you Stadia lovers and Stadia-like and all that. Let's get back to the questions at hand. So you are the founder of Diaspora. I know how to say that word.
Diaspora.
Diaspora, yeah.
Games. Sorry, yeah, that means a lot.
Which focuses on working to expand and diversify the game community and educate the next generation of game developers. Tell me more about what led you to launch Diaspora Games.
So it was in partnership with Glenn Henry from the Jamaica Game Development Society and Sprite Run Studios, which is his own independent studio. Rob Ellsworthy, who's at Toronto Film School as their animation program director. And then he also runs his own indie studio as well. Generally, I think we met through this AGM Black Space exhibition about Black folks in gaming. And we had a panel for it. And so Rob and I had started talking after, through the panel and some of the, questions and just experiences we had been talking about, it became very evident that some of our experiences were similar in terms of access to resources, in terms of, input on process and design, even in my nonprofit world, I had faced that as well. And like in game education. And so just in like kind of all facets, it seemed that there were common things that we could help each other with, and then also common things that we wanted to communicate through games and talk about experiences that we could represent that, were core to the Black experience, and try to, like, there's some times where it's like, if a game is not all games call for it, basically, but we, in our design practices and some of the spaces we were on, it's like to communicate this experience, especially with the lack of Black characters and sometimes where they are represented, it's like in a very narrow way. But in a team where it's not all folks that have that experience, it's hard sometimes, and it takes energy and it takes, vulnerability to really open up and ask or question sometimes, even if it's in the process, not necessarily the assets that may be not reflecting the diversity of the experience of being Black. So I guess to put it down in like, to hone it down, I think like it's hard to communicate being Black sometimes in the industry because of the lack of Black creators. And sometimes you'll want to be like, maybe, we should communicate this differently or include a mechanic that's about Blackness or some, all of these things that might be part of the ideation process all the way through to production. It's nice to be in a group of folks working on these things, separately than our other projects as well, right? Because as I said, there's a space for it, and it's like not all games call for this, but it's nice to have, when working on content like this, have like-minded folks that understand that. And you don't have to do the lifting and the labor it takes to kind of validate that experience. Like, it's already validated, right? And then you can just move forward to like, okay, how do we communicate this and execute it? Whereas in other spaces, there's still that, which even goes up to like, how funding and looking for investors, like all of that now is like, outside of our core production team and how we're making the game, we still have to work within those other structures that we do have to validate the Black experience.
So you kind of really go around, like saying something here. Isn't it just enough that there are Black characters? Like, what is missing? What is missing that when you're in a studio with a bunch of other folk that are not Black or have different races and backgrounds? What is it that you want to say? Hey, this isn't right, or with this off.
Something like, let's make a game about being Black in the 1920s, right? If this was in another studio and it's being pitched against, like, oh, but then here's this cute puzzle platformer about Vikings, or here's this other, like, there's a, to validate that design choice of really focusing on a Black person's experience and what all of that entails, right? It you have to validate why it is compelling past, like, the actual content of it, like the design of, like, the mechanics, all that stuff, but, like, just as an idea, why is it important to tell this experience? Way less labor in a group of Black folks that just understand, like, this Black experience is worth telling.
So I think I want you to define what you mean by a Black experience, that, because I figure you're saying that a lot, but, like, to anyone listening, like, isn't the experience just being Black? Like, what is necessarily a Black experience that you want to share or people want to learn about or see in games?
That's a good question. I think there are some examples, you know, that exist. Especially more recently as time has gone on. I haven't played Deathloop yet, but I'm very excited to play it. And this is not to say that, you know, only Black people should make games about, you know, featuring Black people or focusing on Black people. Of course, Walking Dead is a great example with Lee. I think the Black experience is one that's, like, shared through being othered. And that's why people of color share an experience as well. Just, you know, there's parts of that, but there's also the minutia of, you know, colorism. There's a minutia of, you know, being Black American versus from the Caribbean, and the ideas of what race looks like and what nation looks like, you know, in Jamaica in Jamaica versus in the States, in Canada. And then even further, particularly the Black Canadian experience, and how it's different than both settler nations in the Caribbean and in the States and South America as well. And it's particular, especially when you look through the lens of history, that we can see our lineage and kind of who we are today and how it came to be that, you know, I'm in this place as a colorized person from Jamaica. This lineage is often lost through how we look at Canadian nationhood. And even through doing this project, and our project right now we're working on is called All Aboard. It's a game about train porters, sleeping car porters from the interwar years, from like 1917 to 1925, who was one of the only jobs that Black men could get at the time. So this is what I'm talking about in terms of, like, this whole concept. It's like, I think it's communicating it to other Black folks and other people of color. There's a certain understanding that's kind of, I wouldn't say latent in all cases, but Again, it's not impossible to do otherwise, right? I'm just saying it's less labor, mental labor, to kind of communicate the validity of something like that.
Is there a game that you could think of that you've played or seen that might have a good example of like the Black experience that we all like kind of naturally just understand?
Def Jam, Fight for New York. Have you played that?
No. Have you, Brad?
I think that is an NBA Jam, I guess, kind of.
Oh, NBA Jam.
Are you talking about?
Is that what?
Sorry.
Is NBA Jam the one where you like, they could do like, I don't know, like when you shoot in the net, it does like this cool like animation. It's kind of like, yeah. Like it came out like a billion years ago.
Yeah.
Okay.
Are you talking specifically like narrative?
I'm talking any game that you think that might be. So I asked this question knowing I have an answer as a Black person myself. I just wanted to see what you're thinking of. And you have a lot more experience in games than I do.
No, that's great. Because at the AGM museum Black Space exhibition that I did, that was actually something I did. I asked as many Black people as I could in different like Facebook groups and whatever, just what their favorite games were that, like, especially in relation to being Black and gaming, that you're like, oh, like, I saw myself in this game. So it's a question I love to ask. I'd love to hear yours and Brad, you as well, like where, you know, you felt recognized in a game. But I said Def Jam Fight for New York, because it, you know, so for context, it's a game. It's like its lineage is through THQ, I think, who used to do the wrestling games like No Mercy and WrestleMania 2000 on 64. And they made the Def Jam Vendetta, I think was the first one, on GameCube, PS2, Xbox. And that was like just like a straight wrestling game with a bunch of rappers and people in hip hop. And then Fight for New York was the sequel, but was less, I think they made a new engine for it. So it wasn't like, it did have wrestling aspects, but it was less like a carbon copy of the wrestling games and hip hop setting, and more of its, you know, had unique mechanics and stuff. And then also had, anyways, I could go on about it, but it has a storyline where Method Man is like, Method Man and Red Man are in it, and they're in it as their own characters, you know.
I remember this game actually. Crap.
Yeah. It's sick. And then it also had the map where you could get, you know, it had the clothing part to it, so you could do that, and had the build, and also the martial arts. So it was like a perfect meld of all these different aspects of hip hop style. You know, the Wu-Tang thing with like fighting and kung fu mixed with emceeing, and how emceeing is a form of battling and conflict, and then the cipher, and all those concepts are deeply ingrained in Fight for New York. So I just, and it felt like a game that was for me as a fan of hip hop, you know? And I think that's what I mean by a game that recognizes the Black experience.
That's awesome.
Feeling like it's for you. So anyways, yes. But love to hear what you're thinking too.
Oh, for me? Oh, it's I have an easy one. Just Spider-Man Miles Morales.
Yes.
I just remember I even wrote about this, but I started playing the game, and 5 minutes in, I was just in tears because it just meant so much to me. And it was just, I don't really see myself in Miles Morales, but I have a little brother who was around that age when the game came out as well. And it just reminded me of him. And it was just like, yo, like this is my little brother. Like, this is him living his life and his friends. And of course, my brother doesn't swing around the streets of New York.
Yeah.
But it felt really like it was done well. Like, it felt like they really did try to get the Black experience. I'll use that terminology now too. It did really feel like he tried to get the experience well. I met with some of the animators a few years ago as well, and they were trying to push for that so that it did feel correct. And I think they did a really good job at it. Have you played that game?
I haven't yet.
What are you doing, man?
No, I know. You know what it is? I don't have a PS4 because you know what I had before? Stadia. And then
PS4.
I haven't caught up yet.
You mean 5, bro? What are you doing? They're available everywhere.
They did actually bring Miles Morales to PC recently.
Yes, yeah. So I got when I tell you I'm so behind on playing games, it's wild. Like, I'm finishing Breath of the Wild. Like, that's what's happening. I'm finishing Breath of the Wild. I'm trying to catch up, though, man. Trying to catch up.
For the audio listeners, Dean just gave him the most, like, shady look when he said he was still playing Breath of the Wild.
Right.
So I watch people, I'm like, they're playing Tears of the Kingdom, trying to like avoid videos. I have to play Jedi Survivor still.
Play a game with a black person.
I know. Yeah, for real. Well, that's why Deathloop is literally the first on my list to get to.
The best character in the Jedi games is Seer, and she is black.
Yeah, beautiful. Yep. Yeah.
Not the main character, of course, but arguably in terms of like the importance of the story and teaching Cal and everything, she is certainly
up there. And I'm going to try and give Cal a fade. And then, you know, I'll try and make it work. I'll finesse it. And my character in Red Dead Online is also black, too, so it counts. Anyways, I haven't played that in a while.
It counts, sort of. Brad, you're not black, but you are half Caribbean. Is
Guyanese?
Yeah. Yes. Very good.
Hey.
Yeah. My dad's from my grandparents are from Scotland. So my mom was born here. So yeah, I'm mixed, awesome. Which is a different sort of experience. Which there's not a lot of stories that are about mixed characters. So to the point of feeling seen, first time I kind of felt that in a game was God of War Ragnarok. And that wasn't more of a race-based thing, obviously, it's gods and Norse people, but it's more the whole Atreus as a character who is, you know, half god, half Greek god, half Norse god, basically. And so kind of the duality of his different upbringings and then just the whole daddy issues that he had, I relate to as well. But in terms of like a more of a race-based thing, Annapurna had a game that came out, it was 2022, called Hindsight, which was written by Emma Kidwell, who is half Japanese and half American. So she was kind of writing about her sort of upbringing as having a Japanese mother and an American father. And sort of the game, as the title suggests, Hindsight, is sort of her looking back at her past and sort of reflecting on things and like kind of developing a little more empathy for her mother. It's like, oh, her mother came all the way from this country. And, you know, me and my dad really appreciate that at the time, and I was sort of kind of caught up in my own bottle. So that sort of thing I thought was really cool. There aren't a lot of sort of stories that speak to the sort of mixed experience where you are kind of, you don't necessarily feel like you belong to one or the other necessarily, but kind of taking the best of both worlds in that sense. So that was a really lovely game that really clicked with me.
Yeah, that sounds awesome. And it's I think there's another layer to it when, and this is, I think, where people in the room really makes a big difference, is when the game's mechanics start to reflect that. And it's not just about narrative. It's not just about, you know, what it looks like and the art influence, which are all really important. But then, you know, something we're working on as well. And it's definitely evidence in a lot of games as well, different ways. But we're trying to work on making sure that the mechanics are really reflecting what that experience, you know, is like working things like, how do we do like code switching, you know, in a game mechanic? What's it like cutting hair? Like, there's a is it Hair Na as a game? I think that's a game by a black woman, Hair Na. But that's a one where you are stopping people from touching your hair, and that's the main mechanic. Yeah, see if I can send it to you. So I think when, and that brings me back to, you know, Def Jam as well, like when the mechanics start to reflect it, and that's like when you can only really have people with lived experience of a certain thing, really refine that experience in a way, because, And that's why research is really important, right? And you know, what a lot of things we've been doing with the porters is trying to, the most valuable things are the firsthand accounts. We can see and touch the things and watch movies, but really the lived experience is so key and invaluable when trying to make things about the inexperience, especially at when it's interactive and there's duplicity to it and reacts to the player.
So, firstly, I just mentioned that Miles Morales is half as well, Brad. I mean, half Puerto Rican, half Black. But to dive into the Caribbean side of things, Kadeem, you said that in your bio you are Jamaican. You see, you're Jamaican. Are you first generation Canadian, or were you born in Jamaica? I moved here.
I'm first generation. So my parents, my mom, my dad were both born in Jamaica. My mom came when she was like 14. My dad moved to the States when he was like 10, and then to Canada high school.
I too am Jamaican. Like, same thing.
Hey.
My parents are both from there. I was born here, and then they came up when they were young. I've noticed that there is a significant lack of Jamaican representation in media, video games included. Do you think it's important that, like, the world kind of addresses this, or should we just be satisfied with just Black characters in general? Like, should we be focusing on, hey, let's just get the Black experience out there, or should we be focusing on, let's get the Jamaican experience and the Guyanese experience and all these different experiences into that mix as well?
Yeah, and I guess the question is, like, yeah, I totally hear that, and like, why is it important? There are a bunch of different reasons. You know, I think if you are not a person of color, right, there's a, I mean, it may be evident, may not be. But I think just looking at it, and this is from the straight facts and numbers, if you want to be as departed from it as possible, look at the console market in the US and Europe, right? It's declining. For the first time in, like, you know, since NES in the 90s. So things are so, there's so many games that are doing the same type of thing, so saturated. I think as just a player, right, isn't it nice to play different things that haven't been played before? That's separate than, you know, why representation matters, as, you know, the more that we see things in media, the more that we, replicate that experience. So what we see is really important, as, we are affected by what we consume through media, and what's represented, what becomes normative. All of that is determined through socialization and very heavily relies on how media and social media influences us. So beyond just like, don't you want something new and different to play and not play to, like, not to say there's anything wrong with it, right? Like, we all love first person shooters. Not everyone does, but like, a lot of people do. I love it. But like, sometimes I'd like to play something different that's not, whatever mechanic rehashed. And, I've been playing a lot of Norse, or like seeing a lot of Norse games, and which is all cool, but it's like why not have something different sometimes? And then when we actually look at the effects of media, that's another layer where it's like, it's important to represent people in the diversity that they come, because it becomes, in the, you know, as media affects us, it becomes important to make sure that we have that diversity of representation through. In the launch for Class Rules, I did this contest to have people put in the game. And the contest was to find, to post a Black character, video game character, that was not in a mature game. Or no, I do. No, we did have mature. We included that. But that adds another layer for what you're talking about for kids. But that wasn't a sports character. And wasn't a secondary character. We got like 20, for all game characters. And when you do, if you're talking about for children, you know, who are particularly impacted by games. And when you look at youth who play games in Canada, like I think male kids under 18 and under play games at like 98% likelihood. And then for non-males, it's 92 or 88%, something like that. And that was a few years ago, last I checked. So most kids are playing games. Black people, if you look at the stats, play games at the highest rate of anyone, and or of any, you know, racial group. And so it becomes really important to consider, like, what are these young black kids and kids of color playing? And when you see what the character distribution is of black characters that are not in mature games, that are in sports, you don't have many. Even Miles Morales is a really good example, and that's another reason why I think that game is important as well, because it's not that it is for kids, but it's like, you know, at least it's Spider-Man, you know? It's good in terms of just as a character to have, again, like you're mentioning, Dean, that people can relate to and see themselves in, you know, because it's, we need it.
And you brought up a great point there too, where we get so many of the same kinds of experiences that having the push for representation, obviously, like if you made a game with a black character, not only is it important for people who are black, but for all other kinds of people, not just to teach them about it, but also just to give them a different kind of experience. Like, you know, last year, back to your point about asking me, another thing I was thinking of was Venba was a very big game last year for me. That was made in Canada, actually, in Toronto. And it's a game about an Indian mother who cooks, right? It's a very different kind of game. And there's a very, to the point of the narrative, the mechanics of, you know, making Indian food is sort of bringing her back to her culture and her homeland. So it's like the narrative and the storytelling there. And that's a game that kind of blew up with everyone. Like, it went viral. It got all these awards and everything. And it spoke to people who aren't necessarily just brown. Like, it was just people that, like the whole immigrant experience in general, like regardless of what race you were, people were playing that game. Like, oh, that reminded me of, you know, having food with my mom, who I saw some Jamaican people as well. It's like, oh, it reminded me of making food with my mom from Jamaica as well. So that kind of experience, you know, the creator of that game, Abby, he always said, I'm paraphrasing, but it, you know, by making something very specific like that, it kind of has that universal appeal. Because it is sort of touching on that experience that relates to so many people, regardless of necessarily being brown or black or whatever. So, that's
right.
Great.
I was exactly just going to say that in response. You know, when you really make something that's personal and that resonates with you particularly, or whoever's creating it, in the most, especially through games, the most minute way, because it's the beautiful thing about games as a form of media, and what makes it different from other forms of media, is that it's interactive and that the game can reflect the player, right? And how they move and participate in that experience. I think Victor Lucas at the UTM opening said something really awesome, was that the game is not art until it's played, right? And I think that's a really salient point, that it is the player, whoever you are, regardless of if you are however you relate to the content and the creator of the game, you as a player make it art. In your experience, like you mentioned, there's some people that the Jamaican people going through the game is saying like, oh, I have this that reminds me of something in my life. And it's that dialogue, right, that makes games so beautiful, I think. And what also makes it so powerful, that when you really focus and deliver an experience that's true to what that lived experience is like as whoever you are, or whether you're racialized or whatever, the capacity for someone else to play that and experience it in you know, whatever fidelity you can present it in, I think is one of the things that makes games really special.
Going deeper into this, and what happens when, like, stuff are kind of portrayed for instance, this isn't a game, but the Bob Marley movie coming out, the dude's like not really Jamaican, he's Trini, so he's not even Jamaican, And like the accent is real wrong. My mom and I were just chirping it the other day. And I've played, I play a lot of Apex. And there's Lifeline, whose accent also sounds kind of wrong. And my friends were kind of like, oh, like they're Caribbean or Jamaican. Aren't you happy? And I was just like, not really. But should I have been happy? Should I have just accepted the fact that they are trying to portray this person who has a Caribbean background, or should I want more?
I don't think it has to be a binary choice, you know? I think you can both give them flowers of being like, at least you tried to do something a little different, you know? You try to, there's an importance of, I do love Apex for when you, like all the base characters, you turn it on, especially for Black women and women of color in gaming, also, right? That your standard is, it's, and it normalizes, you know, how FPSs are, and especially online, can be super toxic and everything. So just like doing a part and normalizing all that, awesome. But then it's like, okay, but then was the voice actor from someone from, you know, the culture you're portraying? Are you putting money in the pockets of people that actually look like that? And the, what's your pipeline for building the, you know, hair assets and all this, like who you can, so it's like, you know, what are you doing for the narrative? There are lots of there's so much that goes into it that I think it's like, you know, not being overly critical is important, but it's also like, there is a ton of work to do in terms of all of the stuff around the game, who's profiting from it. You know, and we know what the disparities are in society in general. And yeah, there's just, it takes a lot to be a lot of energy. And, you know, like even Dice War, we can do more, right? We're starting now, but we want to do more education. We want to share our assets and make them deployable so people can use. So there's like so much that you can do to, as, you know, gamers and game creators, that it becomes important to just keep trying and not settle for it being enough. But I think it is, it's a step, and you, for baby steps, positive reinforcement is better than negative reinforcement for a lot of folks, you know? So, yeah, important, but also a ton of work.
Yeah, I hear that. And I was a little happy that they tried. I mean, I don't ever play Lifeline, but you know, I give it a shot.
Yeah.
I've noticed you've said something, you've mentioned something a few times in the last like 40 minutes we've been talking. You keep touching on hair. You've mentioned that a few times. And have you heard the IGN debate, hair debate about Black people in games recently?
No, I haven't.
So recently, we've been noticing there's a hair trend with Black people in games. It's always that like kind of braids to the side. Miles Morales yep. had it. The Prince of Persia. Yep. I don't remember the character's name, but
even Killmonger in Black Panther.
Yep,
it's very common. Why is that? Like, what do you think about that? Do you think that they should be trying to explore different hairstyles, or is it a problem at all? Like I think the hairstyle is kind of cool. Like I noticed it before I saw the video and I was like, oh yeah, I mean, why not? It's a cool hairstyle. But should I be having issues with this, or do you have issues with this?
I have never thought about it until this now, but I totally know exactly what hairstyle you're talking about. I think it's like, have you seen the RDC World skit about the black hair in games? you know, they go to the black characters, the white, like, you know, all the characters have the Goku hair, they have like the emo hair, they have like the whatever, the braids and all the stuff. And then they go to the black characters and they have like a Caesar and an Afro, and those are the two different hairstyles they have. And it's like, no matter how good the game is, they only got the standard hairstyle. And then now, instead of the Caesar and the Afro, you know what it is? The side dread haircut. That's what it is. They just switched to what it is. So I think And this, I think this goes back to your question about what happens when folks are portrayed not in the best way. I think about the character in, is it Tekken? Who's like, he's like this break dancer. Is it Zach? Where's Zach from? And he's just such like a stereotype. It's like, what's his name from the Bulls with the dyed hair? I can't even forget. Dennis Rodman. And he's like basically Dennis Rodman because he's from the 90s. It's a Japanese game. They're like, yeah, this is what black people are like. They're like Dennis Rodman. So it just is like, not that it's cool that he's involved, you know what I mean? Like that they have a black fighting game character. But it's also like, you know, you can see when caricatures and assumptions about the black experience are made through those as well. And then touching back to the hair thing, it's like, that's why it's also important to have people in the room making that, you know, making that type of thing, because it is like black hair texture is a notoriously hard thing to model, you know, and it may not even be that it's harder. It's just different, right? So when folks are allocating resources to make like, okay, we have to make 10 hairstyles here, right? Are they going to lean towards the ones that they already know how to make, that are standard in the industry, that cost, you know, they could do the cost analysis, or are they going to, well, let's R&D and figure out what's the best way to represent this, you know, type of hair, and like have to do some research, and it might take a little wiggle room and some testing and this. So I think those are the real, the cost analysis, right? And some ways it's more expensive to do things outside of the side. And now that's the thing, right? There are, because of the side dread thing has been modeled before, and it's like, oh, there's a, we know how to do it. It's cost effective. It's a, becomes a standard thing to do. Same thing with the Afro, same thing with the Caesar. And then those more, the more minute, you know, hairstyles, like, and the differences between it, become more costly. And at least like you have to put the, that, practice and be able to make them in a certain way, and that's why for us, when we're making our game, we want to make sure that we publicize our pipelines and our assets so that folks use them, because not only the, you know, the assets themselves, but like how to make that is also really important, because it takes time and energy to figure it out, and it's not always a priority for folks, you know. So I think to answer your question, like, it doesn't bother me, but I think it makes evident those, like, in a room somewhere there had to be someone that said, okay, these haircuts are worth it, and we're gonna spend, you know, 10% of this budget on haircuts, on black haircuts, you know. And that was just a decision that was made somewhere, which is cool, right? And understood, like, and then, but then is it, when you really think about it, if, when you look at the numbers of who is actually playing it in the States, right, who's consuming it the most, you're spending 10%, you know what I mean? Then it becomes a question of like, okay, then here's another example of, you know, how racialization affects, it's where capitalism affects product, right? Because then it's like the people that are actually consuming it the most aren't even being considered as much as the people that are not. Why is that? Because it's not because they're consuming it less. It's just because the people in the room weren't making the considerations and realizing who's actually consuming their content the most. And therefore, who should be served through the content of those. But, you know, what are you going to do?
I've been noticing there's like a lot of lack of depth in a lot of black characters in games. I think you kind of even mentioned it earlier. You say the word narrow, how these characters start to feel narrow. How, like, I feel like, for instance, there's not a lot of black characters with disabilities, or black LGBTQ characters, or, as we said earlier, Jamaican characters, or any of that, really. How do we explore that more? I know that with Diaspora Games, like, in a room full of Black people, that's to be easier to explore, right? Because we already got the first, you got the first step done. They're Black, and now you can go deeper than that. But for like other developers or other studios, how could they explore that more? Or do you think it's like, do you think it's worth them exploring it? Should they explore it, or should they leave it for like Diaspora Games or other rooms where there's just Black people or just people of one race? Or
yeah, definitely. I definitely think largely, I think they definitely should. Like a great example of that is Lee Everett, I always think of in Walking Dead. Fantastic character, well-rounded, you know. I'm not sure if you played that, the Walking Dead Telltale games. But he's like at the very start of the game, before like during the zombie outbreak, he's on his way to prison for like, I think for attempted murder or something. So it like, you know, it's very real about the morality of prison. There's all of that is faced through the character, you know, but it doesn't make it about it. It makes it about, you know, how does Lee navigate being like caring for, you know, another person? And you see who he is through how you as a player choose to show his care and his love or not to. And that's what, there are parts where his Blackness comes up. There's one part, one line I won't forget, which is so funny, where one of the characters, Kenny, who's from the South, he's from Texas, or is he from Florida? But Kenny and is cool though. He's like really cool. And it's like one of those things where it's like, unless it was the end of the world, would these two people ever be like actually hanging out? But there's one part where they're like going through a city and they're like looking for things. And Kenny's like, oh, there's a car. Like, you should just jimmy it and get into the car. And then he's like, why would I be able to know how to do that? It's like, so they had moments of it where it was touched on, but it wasn't ever what defined him, which I think is the important thing. And I don't know who was in the writer room necessarily for that, but however they got to it, it was, I think, a really good character. And I think the important thing was just they made him flawed. They made him, you know, it is, you can choose as a player how to, you know, what he does kind of in the narrative to a certain extent. So, but, you know, they just made him a regular person, not a regular person, but like rounded and different aspects to him. And he was like a history teacher or something. So he loved history and whenever it came, like he was interacting with things like that. And he just felt, you know, it's not that he's just the Black guy, you know, it's that he's a guy that likes, you know, that was married. I think his, you know, he was a history teacher, and, you know, he cares for Clementine and then he's also Black, you know? So I think that, and then towards the creation part of it, it's like, if you feel like you don't have, you know, there's one thing I'm realizing I just took a trip to Montreal and I was looking in Little Burgundy, which was the railway town. It still exists now. Like Oscar Peterson grew up there. And so I was looking around and just because doing research for All Aboard, and it just became more evident that like there, I'm like, there's an aspect here that I'm not getting of, you know, a lot of them at the time were Anglophones, but even just being Francophone, living in Montreal, and understanding that, and I'm realizing like, yeah, I need someone that, you know, I need a black Francophone person in the narrative room just to help me understand what that experience is like. And then also just for content, because it's like there's only so much I can understand it, and it's better if someone else just, you know, research and characterize that and inform the rest of us, the you know, on the team of like what that the minutiae as much as they can of what that experience would be like. And that's just me, like, from our perspective and how we go about our design process. It's like when there's a gap in our understanding, instead of just trying to like fill it, it's like just consult, look for people that have that experience and see what they think. Maybe they'll say like, oh no, whatever, it is the same, you know. But unless you ask, how are you supposed to know? And then I do want to shout out, there are some organizations and game development places out there that kind of specialize in narrative services. One is Sweet Baby, based in Montreal, and they are Black run and POC run as well. And you can see some, I think they did some consulting on Spider-Man 2 actually, like Miles Morales. Yeah, so you can tell that when Sony did it, and they did, like, they had a gap and they filled it with people that have that experience, or that have, you know, need to be in the room to be able to make decisions and really make that experience. And it takes, again, it takes effort and labor and time to actually make sure that these experiences reflect who they're about.
No, that makes sense. And I totally agree with that, and think that I wish that there were people like who had these experiences that were more involved in games. I think that would make games feel more fluid and more realistic, at least, or ways for people to learn about what's going on. Like if I play a game like Fenba, I at least get to learn more about like Indian families and how they cook and stuff like that, right? But sometimes I find that these games, like, find that there's a lot of hate for these type of games as well. For instance, when I wrote about Miles Morales and my experience with it, I got a lot of hate in comments in the comment section, just full on racism. So, when people like make games like this, are they kind of fanning the fire in the sense of like, How do you deal with the racism? How do you deal with the racism of it all?
They're mad. They're really mad.
Yeah,
they're
exactly. Really mad.
My patience at this point is like, let them be mad. Because you know what? If you want the straight facts, and I can be like, we don't, in terms of capital, look at Black Panther, right? They said Black Panther wasn't going to be successful. The movie was going to tank. Why? Because it's focused on a Black person, and there's not enough Black people with capital to make it a success. What happened? It was a huge movie, one of Disney's biggest, right? When it came out, especially, I think it was the biggest when it came out, right, of its movies. So there is a late understanding that, you know, just a great larger society would want to instill any of that. Even when I remember we were in a pitch competition thing, or like a training thing with Diaspora, and one of the questions was like, so how are folks that aren't living in this experience supposed to feel like included in the project? And at the time I answered it, whatever, but then as I thought about it more after, it's like, man, why don't I say, like, it's not for you. That's the truth of it. You know what I mean? And Brad, like you're saying, if people happen to relate to the experience, awesome. Like, because we're making it about an experience that's lived and that people went through, and representing that. And if you relate to it, great. But also, if the experience is not about you, then why are you concerned? Don't buy it. Right? It's like, that's what... So, and not that it should be exclusive at all, but it's just like, I don't think art, you know, should be not pandering, but like, art should be cognizant of the creator and what the experience are trying to communicate, and the creatives often too. And you can never include everyone. like, you can include everyone, but you could never make it about everyone all at once, you know? Like, it has to be about something. And as individuals, like, we have experiences that are shared, but, you know, when people try to make any type of media that's for everyone, that's trying to, or that's even just trying to target something without it being genuine to the, to that experience, it's just like, then what is it really about? Like, is it just about profiting, or is it just about, you know, existing to, which, as I said before, is like step one, right? Existing to exist. But then it's like, what is the meaning? Like, what is it? What experience are you trying to communicate? And I think those are all the deeper things that can really have impact. Yeah, that makes sense.
It does make sense. Thanks. And I have one more question for you. Lastly, sure. What would you say to a little Black Kadeem or a little BIPOC Kadeem who is, I don't know, like 10 years old and is interested in making games but worried about, you know, culture stuff and how to get in and what words of encouragement?
Yeah, definitely. As creatives, I know at Diaspora, we're all focused on trying to enable folks that come after us. Because we know the whole reason that we decided to band together is that we know it's not easy. And, you know, in a perfect world, maybe we wouldn't need it. But anyways, we wouldn't need a Diaspora, right? Because it's like we wouldn't, you know, have felt the pressure to need to band together. But I'm glad we did. I would say try and block it out and just make games that make you happy. If you don't know how to make games, start running somewhere. As harsh as the world is, there are still a lot of good people. And games are very difficult to make. It's very hard to make, even with a lot of people. So by yourself, it gets like, is it Bandersnatch? It gets hard by yourself. So try and communicate with people. Find people that, you know, balance your skills, whatever you might have. There's a whole bunch of people that go into making games. So if you can't, you know, math might not be your thing, or you can't code, maybe you draw, or if you can't draw, maybe you like to write stories, or maybe you like to write characters, or maybe you just like to organize stuff, or maybe you like to communicate with people. All of those things are super important in like the business and practice of making games. So the other thing I would say is just follow what makes you happy about games. Maybe it's being, you know, like y'all, like in the press or reporting on it, or there's even people that really love to be testers, like QA, or work on the platform side of it, you know, like Stadia or you know, on the Sony side or whatever. Or at Switch. So there's so many things that you can do that I would just say follow what, or maybe you want to be a pro player and do that. And just do what you enjoy, because that, you know, when you have to do it all day, makes it a lot easier. And be hungry for knowledge, because you never know when those skills can come back and be useful, especially in the context where it's changing a lot. Technology is always changing. And try to make stuff that speaks to you, like we've been talking about, you know. If you want to be an indie developer or like make your own games, I think that's most important, is just make sure as much as you can that it's compelling, that you enjoy it, And then once you have something that you can play, get it out in front of people. Because you need a testing. You know, it's iterative. The whole game design practice is iteration. And so, yeah, that's what that rambling comment is what I would say to my younger self.
No, that was good. That was sweet. Thank you. That is it for me. But Brad, do you have any questions for Kadeem?
No, I mean, that covered it. That was a great conversation. I guess just, you know, you talked a little bit about your game, but that if people wanted to kind of follow you or your work or, you know, Diaspora or anything else, is there anything you want to plug?
Sure. You can find us at diasporagames.ca. Very soon, in imminent announcements coming. But yeah, we're working on All Aboard, which is our debut title. We've also been... you know, entering a soon to early release for Anomaly, which we've done in partnership with Frog in Hand, which is a great, you know, collective design art collective in Mississauga. So we'll be sharing more. And then, yeah, just keep a Jamaica Game Development Society, Toronto Film School, all shout out, Baby Ghosts, all shout out. I don't know who else. There's so many people. Ontario Creates, I can shout out. Great folks there. Interactive Ontario. A lot of folks have been helping us, and Ontario Institute of Studies and Education, UTM, of course. Bunch of folks have been great in helping us really. You know, do what we need to do and connect with people. And even Mobile Syrup, of course. Thank you all for inviting me. This has been great.
No problem. Anytime. But Kadeem, where can people find you? Like if a little kid wants to reach out to you and is like, how do I want to be a game developer. Can I work for Diaspora? How do they reach out to you?
I'm nowhere to be found. No. You can reach me at Kadeem@diasporagames.ca. Or info@diasporagames.ca. Yes, that's the easiest way to get in touch.
Selling a little or a lot? Shopify helps you do your thing however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did we just hit a million orders stage, Shopify is there to help you grow. Shopify helps you turn browsers into buyers with the internet's best converting checkout. 36% better on average compared to other leading commerce platforms. Because businesses that grow, grow with Shopify. Get a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/work. Shopify.com/work.